morning. This is AM. I'm Tony Eastley. High winds and scorching temperatures, low humidity and huge fires already burning. It's a nasty and volatile mix in the Blue Mountains west of Sydney, and it's predicted to get worse as today wears on. The prospect of more devastation just a week after 200 homes were lost in the mountains is a real possibility. Blue Mountains residents have been told bluntly that they should get out of the fire-prone areas by lunchtime today. Reading between the lines of the dire warnings from authorities, it means some areas may not be able to be defended. Standing in the way of the flames is an army of firefighters backed by millions of dollars of special equipment, from bulldozers and bulk water tankers to helicopters. AM's Brendan Trembarth reports from Lithgow.
Helicopters have been in heavy demand as bushfires rage in the Blue Mountains and Lithgow. Joshua Wales from Wollongong-based Touchdown Helicopters flew in yesterday to relieve a fellow pilot who's been here for a week.
And we're basically in the jet ranger doing air observation work, essentially mapping the fire line and looking for hot spots.
He's concerned about the expected winds today, gusting from 40 to 60 knots. If the wind is too fierce, flights will be grounded.
The wind may blow smoke away, but then the wind strengthening will make conditions extremely difficult and dangerous flying in the valleys, particularly for water bucketing operations.
Helicopters are also being used to insert firefighters into rugged terrain.
Landing pads are often difficult. It's not uncommon to find a very small hole and put your crew in. They'll then chainsaw a few trees down and make the landing pad a little bigger. Sometimes you can't even land properly. You do hover exit techniques to get them in and out whilst the helicopter's still in the hover.
Remote area firefighting teams use hand tools to clear vegetation and conduct backburns. Jules Bross from the National Parks and Wildlife Service of New South Wales says it's hot and tiring work, but they're well prepared.
You're always wearing a helmet, you wear protective clothing and your boots and things like that, but of course you're working normally in really hot, rugged conditions, and so you need to take lots of water. That's always the trouble, taking enough water and food for the day as well.
Tony Callan plays a different role in the firefighting effort. The contractor from Bathurst has many a boy's dream job, driving an 18-ton bulldozer.
Basically started with a Tonka toy when I was a kid and thought I wanted to be a bulldozer driver, and have been ever since.
Tony Callan cuts fire breaks behind homes and roads for water tankers to travel. Rocky Gazzoli from A1 Earthworks in Mudgee drives one of the biggest tankers with a 15,000 litre capacity. He fills his truck at a nearby dam in next to no time.
I just pull up alongside the dam, hook your hoses up, start your pumps. Takes me about 12 minutes from go to woe. Then I've got to go to a place where the small units come in and I fill their little trucks.
Rocky Gazzoli expects today will be a tough one, but he's not worked up about it.
Oh, I think in this game, I've been to a few fires, you just got to take day at a time. You're just unsure until the day, depending on the weather, depending on the winds, the temperature. You just got to take day at a time.
Water tanker driver Rocky Gazzoli ending that report by Brendan Trembarth. The opposition says the Abbott government is on the brink of breaking its pre-election promises not to cut health and education spending. The government's Commission of Audit, which will look at where savings can be made, will deliver its final report to the government next March, but it's not likely to be made public until the federal budget is delivered in May. From Canberra, Naomi Woodley reports.
The Treasurer, Joe Hockey, says the government will maintain its pre-election promise not to reduce funding for health, medical research, education or defence, despite giving its Commission of Audit scope to look at every line of government spending.
But it doesn't mean that you can't identify waste in those areas and reallocate it to other priorities in the same portfolio.
But Labor and the Greens are suspicious.
So you can slash money to hospitals, but if you're putting a new drug on the PBS at the same time, that won't constitute a cut.
The opposition's finance spokesman, Tony Burke, says it puts everything on the table.
I don't think anyone in Australia, when they heard Joe Hockey give a guarantee that there would be no cuts to health, thought that that would give him permission to slash funding to hospitals. And yet the way he's redefined it, that's exactly what he'd be able to do.
The Greens leader, Christine Milne, is suspicious about the five-month deadline for such a comprehensive look at government spending.
Whether it's actually a genuine audit remains to be seen.
The results won't be immediately known. The Treasurer says the report will be publicly released along with the budget in May. Labor's Tony Burke says that fits an emerging pattern.
Everything this new government does builds on a culture of secrecy.
Amongst the terms of reference, the Commission's clearly being asked to look at the level of government welfare and benefits with an emphasis on people providing for themselves. Christine Milne says the language of co-payments, incentives and user charges raises questions.
Whether we're going to end up with essentially targeting people who are least well off in our community and driving them further into poverty whilst entitling those who already have a great deal to have even more. But let's wait and see what happens with this Commission of Audit.
The more immediate question is the Commonwealth debt limit. Neither Labor or the Greens are likely to block the government's request to lift it by $200 billion to $500 billion. But both Tony Burke and Christine Milne want more information before saying yes.
The right thing for the government to do is to not continue with this secrecy, but to simply make the public accounts known.
Why do they need the debt ceiling increased by $200 billion, given their hysteria at the very prospect of a $50 billion increase previously, and what do they want to spend it on?
The government says the current cap will be breached in early December, so it needs to set a new limit before then.
Naomi Woodley reporting. The Federal Treasurer, Joe Hockey, says privatisation is not going to be the cash cow that delivers big amounts of revenue to bring down Australia's debt. That leaves the Coalition looking at cuts, and Mr. Hockey says it would not be breaking an election promise if his audit finds waste in health or education. Joe Hockey told Louise Yaxley he's asking for one big increase in Australia's debt ceiling to avoid a series of political stoushes over it.
I think the thing that undermines market confidence and business confidence is when the government says we will not exceed a certain level of debt and then keeps going back to the Parliament or back to the Congress to get it lifted. And what we want to do is be in a position where we only do this once to fix up the mess we inherited and then get on with the job of making sure that we start to live within our means.
Why, though, compare Australia and the US? They are very different, aren't they? For a start, $500 billion versus $17 trillion.
Well, we all go to the same markets to get our funding, whether it be the United States or Europe or any other country.
In terms of paying off the debt, how much can be offset by privatisations, and are you happy for Australia Post, say, to be sold off to help?
Well, the fact is, Louise, that there is just not a lot of money left in privatisations at a federal level that is going to work to pay off the debt. The only way you can start to pay off the debt in any meaningful way is to grow the economy, to improve the state of the budget, to run surpluses and run year after year of budget surpluses, which at the end of the day go to pay down the debt. There is no Telstra, there is no Commonwealth Bank.
There is an Australia Post, though.
Well, Australia Post is not the same business model as Royal Mail in Britain or any others, and frankly, whether it be Australia Post or Medibank Private or any other number of entities, the combined value is very small compared to the debt levels that we've inherited from Labor.
Will you be using the scope in the debt ceiling for some big infrastructure projects like a new Sydney airport, and is it Badgerys Creek as reported today?
Well, we have been very upfront in saying that we need to harness the enormous amount of private sector savings to help to build Australia's infrastructure for the 21st century, to focus on retooling the nation. The infrastructure we build must be productive infrastructure, and we have already pledged, Tony Abbott has pledged, and we will deliver cost-benefit analyses of individual proposals that are going to ensure that we do not waste taxpayers' money, but also provide a platform for private investment. I mean, this is a partnership to rebuild the nation, and we need to encourage private sector investment into Australian infrastructure.
Is the Sydney airport something that you see as a priority for getting Australia moving? Is that where your priorities lie?
Well, without nominating individual projects, anything that improves the productive capacity of the nation is going to be a priority project.
Labor warned that an audit would mean big cuts and job losses. Does the fact that you've put such a tight time frame on this show that you want to get these politically painful decisions out early into the life of your government?
Well, no, the timetable is focused on getting on with the job. Gee whiz. I mean, Labor complaining about the debt and then complaining about us trying to fix the debt is pretty rich. It's pretty rich. I mean, the hypocrisy is astounding from Labor.
Okay, so clear up for us. If you cut health or education because you say you found wasteful spending, why should people not see that as a broken promise?
Well, because we've always said that if you can make savings within portfolios, and in the case of health and education and defence, reallocate the money into that portfolio so that the overall pool of funds is not diminished, then that's exactly the right thing to do.
The Federal Treasurer, Joe Hockey, speaking to Louise Yaxley in Canberra. And you're listening to AM around Australia, where it's 21 minutes past seven. A gathering of Western and Arab foreign ministers in London has urged Syria's moderate opposition to attend peace talks in Geneva next month and to present a united front. But that's far from certain. The Syrian National Coalition will meet in just over a week to decide if it will attend those talks. While the foreign ministers have called for President Bashar al-Assad to play no role in Syria when a transition government is finally established, the US Secretary of State did suggest it could be up to Syrians themselves to decide if Assad would run for elections in the future. Here's Europe correspondent Mary Guerin.
The meeting was to bolster the Syrian moderate opposition's resolve to come to the negotiating table. Along with foreign ministers from 11 countries were leaders of the Syrian National Coalition that's still to decide whether it will come to what's been dubbed the Geneva II talks. One key group within the opposition alliance has threatened to boycott the Geneva meeting. British Foreign Secretary William Hague strongly urged a united front.
Geneva offers the Syrian people the best hope to improve their lives.
US Secretary of State John Kerry made it clear the talks are the only way forward.
I don't know anybody, including the Russians and others in the region who are not part of the support group, who believe that there is a military solution to this conflict.
Mr. Kerry was standing at the same podium where his apparently off-the-cuff remark about the removal of chemical weapons led to the diversion of seemingly imminent military strikes. But he warns progress on that front isn't enough.
Removing the chemical weapons does not remove the crisis, and it doesn't remove the humanitarian catastrophe that is unfolding before the world's eyes.
The ministers resolved to put in place greater support for the political and military wings of the moderate opposition, but their communique set no specific deadline for creating the transitional government, saying it would happen within the coming months. The meeting did agree that when the transitional government is established, President Bashar al-Assad and, quote, his close associates with blood on their hands will have no role in Syria. Mr. Hague said this was in line with the views of the Syrian National Coalition president.
We're as clear as he is that Assad has no role in a peaceful and democratic Syria.
But in response to a question from the floor, Mr. Kerry did seem to suggest President Assad's future role is not clear.
That's for the parties to negotiate. That's not for us to predetermine. The key is that you have full executive authority that is transferred. It's not our decision to make.
Much is out of the West's hands. Even John Kerry said while he hoped and believed the peace talks would happen next month, other parties would have to make their own decisions about who would come to the table. This is Mary Guerin in London for AM.
The White House insists the deaths of civilians in US drone strikes cannot be labelled as war crimes and that the attacks against militants are precise and effective. A joint report by Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International is calling on the Obama administration to come clean on how many people it's killed. Correspondent Lisa Miller reports.
The report's authors admit that each drone strike is difficult to verify, but they've taken a handful of cases and found multiple witnesses, like the death of 68-year-old Manana Bibi on a sunny October day last year. Amnesty International's Mustafa Quadri says she was doing nothing to warrant targeting.
Her grandchildren recounted in painful detail to Amnesty International the moment when she was blown into pieces in front of their very eyes while she was gathering vegetables.
Letta Taylor from Human Rights Watch spoke of the deaths in Yemen of 12 people travelling in a van. She says the US was targeting an al-Qaeda militant.
But that target was nowhere in sight. It turned out that all 12 people killed were villagers coming home from market. Their loved ones found their charred bodies in pieces on the roadside, dusted in flour and sugar that they were bringing home to their families.
The US has carried out hundreds of drone-assisted missile strikes, the numbers increasing during the presidency of Barack Obama. But Amnesty says the administration's secrecy makes reporting of the program difficult. In May, President Obama spoke at the National Defense University and promised to narrow the parameters for the use of drones to limit collateral casualties. And today, the White House spokesman Jay Carney defended the administration's policies.
They are lawful and they are effective. And the United States does not take lethal strikes when we or our partners have the ability to capture individual terrorists. We take extraordinary care to make sure that our counterterrorism actions are in accordance with all applicable domestic and international law and that they are consistent with U.S. values and U.S. policy.
Noreen Shah from Amnesty International says there's been no new information from the administration since the president's speech.
We're asking President Obama to come clean about who the U.S. government is killing, not just to make a pledge of transparency or make a promise that things are going right, but to say who has been killed, how many people have been killed, and what the legal and factual justification for these killings was.
The drone program has given the US major diplomatic headaches, especially with Pakistan, which has publicly opposed the attacks. It's a subject that's likely to be near the top of the agenda when Barack Obama and Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif meet in Washington tomorrow. This is Lisa Miller in Washington for AM.
Geoscientists with the CSIRO in Perth have discovered that gold particles in the leaves, twigs and bark of eucalyptus trees. The researchers believe the trees are sitting on top of gold deposits buried deep underground, and the roots of the trees suck up the gold in their search for moisture during times of drought. Kesha West has more.
The gum tree is unmistakably Australian. Now the eucalypt could hold the key to vast deposits of gold buried deep underground in some of the country's more remote areas.
We weren't expecting this at all. To actually see the gold particles in the leaves was quite a eureka moment for us.
Dr. Melvin Lintern is a research geochemist at the CSIRO in Perth, and the lead researcher on a study that has for the first time found gold particles within a living material.
These trees are sort of telling us what's going on down under. The particular trees that we did the research on appear to be bringing up gold from a remarkable 30 metres depth. I think it's about the equivalent of a 10-storey building.
The research group were able to see the gold with the help of the Melbourne-based Australian synchrotron.
We can analyse very, very small particles of gold at very high resolution, very quickly.
The discovery, the first of its kind in the world, will undoubtedly generate huge interest from within the gold mining and exploration industry. Nigel Radford has worked in mineral exploration his entire working life, most recently with US-based Newmont, one of the world's biggest gold mining companies.
A lot of this stuff has been speculated about for some time, but the identification of the gold particles in the leaf material is completely convincing and very, very important for the future of mineral exploration.
Nigel Radford believes it has the potential to make gold exploration a lot quicker and cheaper.
Ideally, any mineral exploration team would like to collect their samples on surface. If you can sample on surface, it saves all the cost and all the time involved in drilling holes.
And it's not just Australia's famous gum trees that could hold the clue to untapped gold. The CSIRO researchers say they've found gold in the leaves of other trees, like the acacia mulga.
We've actually found gold in not only in trees, but in shrubs that are growing beneath the trees as well. So not restricted to any particular trees at all.
But don't rush out and start collecting leaves just yet. Dr. Lintern says even if you had 500 trees growing over a gold deposit and managed to extract all the gold from every bit of those trees, you would only have enough gold for for a wedding ring.
Kesha West with that report. To finance, Wall Street has closed 0.5% higher after the lower than forecast jobs growth spurred speculation that the US Fed Reserve won't be rushing to cut back its economic stimulus program. While America's jobless rate has fallen slightly to 7.2%, job creation in September was well below estimates. The news pushed the US currency to a two-year low. As a result, the Australian dollar is higher, and this morning it's trading just above 97 US cents. I'm Tony Eastley, and that's AM for today.